BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, it's 16 days since Russian forces invaded Ukraine.
And today we heard Vladimir Putin basically welcoming the idea of foreign fighters, volunteers, to come and fight on his side in Ukraine.
Наемников и направлений их на Украину мы видим, они не скрывают западные спонсоры Украины.
So basically he's saying, well, the West is doing it. They're gathering all sorts of mercenaries to go and fight in Ukraine, breaking international norms, as he said. So if that's the case, then we should do it too. Especially, he said, if they're willing to do it for free. What he means by that, I think, or at least we saw some pictures of Syrians getting together, holding those Z signs and Russian flags, apparently ready to volunteer.
Do we know what they might be chanting there?
Well, I can hear the word Bashar. I don't speak Arabic, or only a little bit. But as far as I understand it, they're saying something like, we pledge to sacrifice ourselves for you, Bashar, Bashar al-Assad, the Syrian president, who basically is only still in power thanks to Vladimir Putin.
And as you just said, President Putin said, well, the West are doing this. And here are some volunteers from Norway and Austria who are willing to fight alongside the Ukrainians.
So I can just sit at home watching it, being safe at home, when I knew that this was happening over there. We're going in and we have certain contact numbers and then we'll be guided from there.
The point about that is that it sort of feels like this is dragging ever more strands and countries and people into this conflict, right? It feels a little bit dangerous, doesn't it? When we keep in the back of our minds, we're thinking about World War III, essentially. When you see kind of people from Syria, people from Norway getting involved, you think, uh-oh.
This is Ukrainecast.
Ukrainecast from BBC News.
The question for us now is to be or not to be.
I'm ordering the Minister of Defence to put the strategic nuclear forces on special alert.
I could not imagine that I would find out that actually my home is bombed.
Putin is the aggressor.
He will never be able to cleanse the blood from his hands.
Hello, this is Gabriel in the studio in London.
Hello, this is Victoria, also in the studio in London.
And I'm Vitaly, also in the studio in London.
As always.
So three new cities have come under attack overnight in Ukraine. Tell us where they are and what's happened, Vitaly.
This is devastating news to people in Ukraine, especially refugees, because these cities were generally seen up until today as safe havens to flee to from all the fighting in the east, in the south and in the north. Two of those cities, as far as I know, they'd never been subjected to such airstrikes before. Dnipro in central Ukraine, a massive city of almost 1 million people. The other one, Lutsk in northwest Ukraine, very close to the border with Poland. And the third one, Ivano-Frankivsk, also in the very extreme west of Ukraine, but the airport there had been hit before. And now, talking to people in Ukraine who have fled from the fighting, they're extremely alarmed. If those three cities have been targeted, what about their cities? Lviv in particular, where there are hundreds of thousands of refugees from all over Ukraine. And they're now trying or thinking of moving on to Poland in particular. And it seems that there's no safe place anywhere in Ukraine anymore.
I mean, Lviv is not too far from Ivano-Frankivsk, is it?
It's very close. It's the next big city. And also, it's where a lot of refugees have gone to. Mm. And the question for them now is, where do we go now?
Isn't Ivano-Frankivsk where Anna ended up?
That's exactly where Anna went to when she left Kharkiv with her family. She updated us yesterday. Obviously, we've got in touch with her today to say, how are you? What did you hear? How are you feeling, having thought you'd gone to a safe place and it's been attacked overnight? This is what Anna says. We are safe. We're still in my mum's friend's basement. We didn't hear much. We weren't directly affected by the bombing as it was quite far away from where we are. We heard sirens yesterday, but there have been sirens on and off for the last day or so. It is ironic, I guess, says Anna. I'm not sure how to say that in English, that the city was safe before we got here and now we are here. It has been bombed. We are planning to stay here, though, for the time being. Our end destination is Canada. But because my dad can't leave the country right now, we are just going to stay and see what happens. I can't really articulate how I'm feeling about this situation, that we have arrived here and it's now been bombed. It's sad, I guess, but we are okay for now.
How did she send us this message?
We rang her briefly because she's got a lot on, and she just told us over the phone a quick update so that we could report back for Ukrainecast listeners.
Vitaly, what do we make of these latest attacks on these other cities? What do we think this tells us about what the Russians are doing?
The geography of their airstrikes is expanding. They're trying to capture more territory. For the past several days, we've been hearing about cities like Mariupol and Kharkiv. They'd been pounded for days. And now the Russians have their sights on more cities. Seeing what has happened before, how indiscriminate their shelling can be, this is really chilling news for Ukrainians. This morning in Dnipro, local officials said that a Russian bomb fell near a kindergarten residential area. At least one person has been killed, and that's exactly what frightens Ukrainians.
Mm. And in those two cities in the west, Lutsk and Ivano-Frankivsk, were they targeting civilian or military infrastructure?
In Ivano-Frankivsk, it was a civilian airport, which had been targeted before. In Lutsk, there was an airfield, which appears to have some military use. So that seems to be their target.
I think we can speak now to Vitaly Paschenko, a 19-year-old student in Lutsk. Vitaly, can you hear us?
Absolutely.
Hi, Vitaly. How are you and what's going on there?
Today we had a very challenging moment, a very tragic moment, because four people have been killed as the result of the Russian missile attack. I woke up because of the very strange noise. I instinctively went to the window to see what is going on. And I looked at the general direction of the aerodrome, and I saw minor flames. And 10, 15 seconds after that, there was a sight of some object moving very fast in the direction of the aerodrome, and then there was an explosion. So there was a huge fireball, and it was followed by a rather strange sight. It was like a confetti made out of silver, and was climbing up and up. Then there was this mushroom, and the sky itself was turned into dark, because the military aerodrome was targeted along with the petrol terminal, which is adjacent to the aerodrome. So when the petrol burns, the flames, everything, the smoke was unimaginable. I never saw anything like it in my city or anywhere else for that matter.
And as you saw this, Vitaly, what was in your mind? What was in your heart?
Well, I have to say that when I saw the fireball, the heart literally stopped. You know, I was seeing that as the events were unfolding. I almost cried, and it was just to that point when you literally felt like you're losing your consciousness. You cannot believe that what is going on, what is happening in front of your eyes, is happening in reality.
How far away were you from it?
I live in just under 4 kilometers from the aerodrome. Mm. Technically, I live in a city, but it's a rural area, and there are no tall buildings that separate the aerodrome and my home. So there are just fields, and everything was visible very clearly. And just as I perhaps mentioned, 7 or 8 seconds after the explosion was seen, we experienced a terrible wave blast. So the house was vibrating. And I mean, it's a three-story large house, and I felt like the vibrations were happening.
My goodness, and you're 4 kilometres away.
Yeah.
That must have been huge.
Indeed.
And who is in your home? Obviously you. What about your parents, and do you have brothers and sisters?
I live with my two siblings and with my mother and father. My siblings and mum, they evacuated to Poland just a couple of days ago. They live in a border city called Wodawa. And it was my ask, it was my request to my parents that they should evacuate my mom and my siblings, because I received an information from a source of mine whose father works in the upper echelons of the national police. And he said that the invasion from Belarus is now imminent. And I told that to my parents, and we made a decision that they should rush to the Polish border as soon as possible. So just in under 1 hour, they were packed and ready to go. But the time when the explosion today happened, my mom actually returned back to Ukraine because she brought humanitarian aid. So the three of us were in the house.
Right, yeah. Right, right.
And your dad is using his hotel, his restaurant business to help people put them up or feed them?
Yes, yes. My family, we own a small business. We have a restaurant and we have a hotel, sports complex. We made changes in the sports complex to facilitate the accommodation, emergency accommodation of refugees. As far as I know, 15 to 20 people now live there. Plus, we have a hotel, lots of refugees from eastern parts of our country, including Kharkiv, of course, and Sumy. Plus, we have people from the capital, Kyiv. And the restaurant, of course, is open to everyone. We have free lunches for the members of the National Police, for the servicemen and women of the armed forces, battalions of territorial defense. Everyone is doing their part to ensure we make these people feel at least as comfortable as we can.
And these people who fled to Lutsk from the east, do they feel safe in Lutsk now?
Yesterday, I would have been inclined to tell you that, yes, they feel safe. Not anymore. Mm.
And you're still there and your dad is still there because you weren't able to go, because men of a certain age had to stay there in case they needed to fight?
Absolutely. So all men aged 18 to 60 are currently prohibited from crossing the state border.
And you're 19, Vitaly, is that right?
Yes, I'm 19. I'm a student in Kyiv. So, yes,
what are you studying?
I'm prohibited to. I'm majoring in, as fate would have it, I'm majoring in international law, specifically international public law.
Right, that's quite relevant at the moment. Mm.
Your English is incredible. Do you mind me? I hope you don't mind me saying that. It's absolutely incredible.
I try my best to sound as close as I can to the native speakers, but it took me lots of years to master and perfect my English, and I'm still on that road. I still don't think that I'm close to being, looking or sounding like a native speaker, but I'm getting there.
Doing pretty well, I'd say. What should we make of this strike? Do we think it was a strike on a military target? Or, I mean, presumably it was, right? So,
according to the international law, of course, and to the rules of the combat, the attack that happened today technically might not be considered a war crime or anything of that sort, because the target was the military aerodrome, obvious target where no civilians should have been present. But I was informed just under an hour ago, there was a statement by the mayor of Lutsk, Mr. Iho Polishchuk, who said that the personnel of the military aerodrome together with the rescuers found two more people in the wreckage. I believe they were civilians. Mm. So they were collateral targets of this attack.
We should probably just talk a little bit about where Lutsk is. I mean, it's way, way in the west of Ukraine, right? It's pretty close to the Polish
absolutely.
Border.
It's about, if you were in a car from the capital to Lutsk, it's about 5.5 hours. It would be a 5.5 hour drive.
As fate would have it, I drove through Lutsk a couple of weeks ago and I hadn't realised it's got this amazing castle in it. Can you just describe it, Vitaly?
Oh, yes, the famous Lubert Castle. So Lutsk, in the times of the Grand Lithuanian Duchy, during the times of the Duke Lubert and of Vytautas, it was one of their favorite places. In fact, historians say to us that Lutsk in the 15th century was considered a second capital of the Grand Lithuanian Duchy. So Lutsk is a city with a proud history. Castle has withstood the horrors and the atrocities of two world wars. It had never surrendered to not a single enemy, which I also believe signifies the dignity and the pride that we here in Lutsk have.
Gabriel's just showed me photographs of it on his laptop. It says here it's one of the best castles in Ukraine.
I mean, it's like a proper fairy tale on a moat.
Yeah, it's on a slight hill. Yeah, with a main turret and an arch that you could imagine. You know, that's where everybody would travel through, and then a big wall, which is still intact.
What's so interesting about this for me is that it you look at this castle, and as you just described it, Vitaly, it tells you that Ukraine has for centuries been right at the centre of this turbulent European history, right? With all of these different empires and states fighting each other, talking to each other about territory and influence and power. And once again, Ukraine finds itself right in the middle of things. Vitaly, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much indeed.
Take care. I hope it didn't sound flippant to ask Vitaly, you know, about his excellent English language skills, but
no, I don't
so
think so.
Many
yeah.
Ukrainians
I've
speak
really been struck
brilliant
by
English.
I've really been struck by that. And, you know, Vic, I lived in Ukraine in 2008, 2009, and I don't remember there being that many English speakers who were that fluent. I think English has really taken off in the past decade or so in Ukraine, maybe more. And I think part of the reason for this is Ukraine's westward looking ambitions. You know, the whole conflict that Ukraine has been engaged in is about it wanting to look westward. And there's a really interesting detail. In 2004, Ukraine won the Eurovision Song Contest. And as a result of that, it obviously hosted it the following year. That's how it works. So you win it, you host it the following year.
Thank you. Thank you.
I'm sorry. I am not very up on Eurovision. So, but anyway, yeah. Fair point, Vic. Thank you. Anyway, as a result of that, they opened up their borders to visa-free travel for Europeans because, you know, all
they
these
wanted everyone to come,
right?
Celebrate.
That coincided with the Orange Revolution, in which a pro-Russian president who had rigged an election was toppled by massive street protests, and it brought in Viktor Yushchenko. You'll remember him. He was poisoned by the Russians. You remember the pockmarked face and all of that.
And you're linking the two.
Yeah, that really was the moment, I think. It obviously wasn't the major cause of that revolution, but many people have linked it as a sort of contributing factor to Ukraine's sort of westward turn, if you like, and maybe also a contributing factor to this proliferation of amazing English speakers that we've seen.
Can I just say on the subject of Mariupol, which has now been shelled for days,
more than
actually
a week.
Lost count of how many days it's been shelled. People have been trying to escape. There's supposed to be these human corridors, these sort of safe, you know, no bombing to allow them to escape. It hasn't really happened. It's happened a bit. But there are still people trapped there. They'll have no food, no water. We obviously have been trying to talk to somebody in Mariupol, to talk to listeners, and we just cannot get through to anybody.
Communications are down. And until last night, local officials have been able to make desperate appeals from inside the city. People like the mayor of Mariupol, Vadim Boychenko. But today, we haven't heard from him yet. The last we've heard from him was this desperate appeal last night, where he spoke slowly, staring in front of himself. And he spoke of hell, Armageddon.
2 days, ада, Армагеддона, который нам устроили русско-фашистские войска.
And he kept using the word cynical. He kept accusing the Russians of cynicism.
Это цинизм. Они цинично держат в плену 400 тысяч мариупольцев.
He said, they keep saying that there are safe ways out of the city. When we try and leave the city or get our people out of the city, it turns out that the roads out of the city are mined, that they're shelling them. And he says it's just, and I quote, a genocide of the Ukrainian people in that city.
Can I just pick up on this genocide point? Because This whole thing began when Russia said that Ukraine was conducted a genocide against Russians, stroke Russian speakers in Ukraine, which was clearly not true. In recent days, I've noticed that Ukrainian officials have started using the word genocide. To be clear, that's also not true, right?
Well, it's striking how similar are the accusations traded by the Russians and the Ukrainians. In terms of genocide, what they mean is that if you have any determination to fight for Ukraine, you will be branded nationalist, you will be dehumanized by the Russian media machine and Russian officials. And that's why they say that the Russian army and Russian officials are keen to destroy the very heart of the Ukrainian nation, the very idea of the Ukrainian soul. And that's what we heard from the mayor of Mariupol last night, Vadim Boychenko. He said, you can't really see it any other way. It's a genocide.
So my problem with this, frankly, is that if you give credence to that being a genocide, you know, bombardment of civilian areas being a genocide, then you kind of also lend credence to the Russian use of the word genocide.
Why?
Well, because the Ukrainian military and pro-Russian separatists have been fighting a war for 8 years in Donbass, and both sides have been shelling each other. That's what the Russians are calling genocide. They are saying the Ukrainian shelling of the Donbass constitutes a genocide. Now, it does not constitute a genocide very patently, clearly, under international law. My worry is that this kind of proliferation of the use of the word genocide not only devalues the word, but also lends legitimacy to the Russian claim.
In our last episode, you remember we talked about the information war and that we needed to question every bit of information, as you were just illustrating, in fact, treat everything with scepticism. There's an announcement from the owner of Facebook and Instagram today. They're called Meta, and they say they will allow users in some countries to call for violence against Vladimir Putin and Russian soldiers, like death to the Russian invaders, quote unquote, even though it would potentially break their guidelines. Why? Why are they doing that? Good PR?
Don't ask me. I mean, it's terrible PR for the Russians. They can say, ha, look, you see these American companies, they're making exceptions. You're only allowed to call for the death of Russians, but not the death of anyone else, right? I can't for the life of me imagine why Facebook stroke Meta thinks this is a good idea.
You'd hope that some thinking has gone into that decision. And what it tells us is that reputational risks of associated with disallowing those kind of extreme statements, they probably outweigh, in the eyes of executives at Meta, the risk associated with allowing those statements. So they just said, yeah, let's allow them, otherwise we'll pay a higher price.
They also probably think that their business in Russia doesn't have very bright prospects.
Yeah, because
well, within the past hour, the Russian prosecutors, they had gone to court asking for Meta to be outlawed as an extremist organization.
As a result of this change?
Well, it comes, they didn't say it in as many words. Right. It comes after their statements. But Facebook has been banned in Russia before, and now they are seeking for their parent company to be outlawed as an extremist organization.
I would put it alongside the sort of reverse use of the word genocide as a info war own goal.
Would you?
Yeah, I would.
Okay.
As a Russian who consumes state media passively, or maybe is sort of in some kind of in-between space of, like, is it okay what my government's doing, or is my government right? If you suddenly see that Facebook has said that the one set of people who are allowed to be called upon to be killed on Facebook are Russians, where do you think that's going to send them?
We're going to talk now to Justin Bronk. Justin is a research fellow in air power and technology at the Royal United Services Institute. Justin, hello. Welcome to Ukrainecast.
Hi there.
Thank you very much for talking to us. Why don't you just give us your assessment of how this war is going so far?
So I think there are essentially two quite different pictures. In the northeast, there is heavy fighting, but the Ukrainian forces seem to be doing very well. They have continued to inflict heavy casualties on Russian advanced elements, and they've also continued to very effectively interdict Russian supply convoys, which are largely road-bound. because they're mostly wheeled vehicles, and it's obviously mud season. So particularly in the north of the country, it's extremely wet and difficult to move off-road, which makes it easier, especially in forested terrain, for Ukrainian light forces to ambush and destroy supply convoys.
They have a lot of people, a lot of tanks, a lot of their vehicles and techniques, but we fight in our land and we protect our families. So it doesn't matter how they fight. We fight like lions and they won't win.
On the other hand, down south, the picture looks a lot more serious for the Ukrainian forces. There were far fewer Ukrainian forces in the south because basically the terrain north of Crimea is very flat and open. There's not much cover, and it favours forces with a lot more firepower and armoured mobility, which the Russian forces have.
Can we read anything into what we think the Russians' strategy is through all of these kind of movements that you've described?
The basic strategy has shifted. Clearly, their initial approach was based on A, almost no planning, and B, dreadful assumptions in terms of the likelihood of sustained Ukrainian resistance and also their ability to decapitate the Ukrainian state. When that failed, it's taken them a while to reset. But the emerging strategy now seems to be to fall back on the playbook that they supported the Syrian Assad regime very effectively and brutally in doing, which is to basically encircle the cities one at a time, or in this case, as many as they can, but to encircle the cities. And because they don't have the manpower to basically take those cities street by street, the playbook is to, once they've encircled them, to cut them off, starve the population out, and basically just bring them under sustained bombardment for weeks at an end with artillery and airstrikes to make life completely untenable in those cities and force a surrender that way. So they seem to be trying to set the conditions, particularly through the sieges of Mariupol, Kharkiv, and Sumy, to kind of present Kiev with an impossible choice as to whether to continue to resist, because at a strategic level, Ukraine is probably in a stronger position than a lot of people realize. Russia can't hold all of Ukraine, probably can't even sustainably hold the cities that it already has encircled if it were to take them, because the scale of resistance is likely to be so high over the long term. But if it can present Kiev with these sort of impossible humanitarian catastrophes in its cities, then the hope from the Russian regime seems to be that they can force Kiev to accept surrender terms or ceasefire terms that effectively give them something they can claim as a victory.
What seems to me so extraordinary, Justin, you know, that might make tactical sense, military sense from a Russian point of view, but historically and emotionally, the spectre of the Second World War and Stalingrad and, you know, the siege of Leningrad is such a collective trauma for both Ukrainians and Russians.
And both sides are now appealing to that memory. Both Russians and Ukrainians say we are fighting against fascists.
But just the very spectre of encircling and starving and bombarding big cities, it strikes me that if Russia goes down that route, it will irrevocably cut itself off emotionally.
They're already doing it. They're doing it in Mariupol.
For the past 6 days, the Ukrainians have been trying to get humanitarian supplies to Mariupol. They're not getting through. They've been trying to evacuate civilians out of Mariupol. They are not allowed to leave.
I suppose what I'm saying is I find it so hard to believe that this country, Russia, which has this collective trauma, is doing exactly what was done to it in the 1940s, led by a man, Vladimir Putin, who grew up in Leningrad and whose older brother died during the siege of Leningrad. I find it hard to wrap my brain around.
Justin, how do you square the two, if that's the right phrase?
Yeah, no, so I think this strategy guarantees the failure of the initial political aim of basically forcing Kiev and Ukraine as a whole back into the Russian fold, or at least enforced neutrality. As you said, you know, the brutality and the sheer level of inhumane destruction that's being visited on Ukrainian cities, especially in the parts of the country, Mariupol and Kharkiv, which are, you know, more Russian speaking than lots of it, and where, you know, there was genuine kind of, in some cases in Kharkiv, for example, some counter protests to the ouster of Yanukovych back in 2014. You know, this should be the easier part of Ukraine to win for the Russians in terms of hearts and minds. But in pursuing this strategy, they've absolutely guaranteed the country will hate them forever. And so if they want to control it long term, they would have to basically occupy it in large scale, which I don't think they can do. I don't think they have the troops or the resource.
One more question from Ukraine Cast listener Matt in Amsterdam. He asks, By bombing civilian infrastructure, residential areas and previously agreed evacuation corridors, and potentially using chemical weapons, is President Putin trying to provoke NATO governments into using force in Ukraine, thereby escalating the war on a pan-European scale? If so, what would be in it for him?
So there is certainly an effort by the Russians to prep the ground, as it were, for any use they might try to do of chemical weapons. And certainly the US intelligence community is really worried about this, as same in the UK, that they may try and do this in order to basically, you know, further up the pressure on the Ukrainian government to give in just by inflicting so much suffering on besieged populations. But at the same time, there's certainly, I think, a desire to deter the West from direct military intervention. But I'd also caution that, you know, if we were to intervene directly with say, you know, no-fly zone or whatever that the people have been putting forward, it would be direct military combat between NATO assets or Western assets and Russian aircraft and surface-to-air missile batteries. And B, it would give Putin two very valuable things for him domestically. The first one would be an existential conflict that would allow him to justify more easily use of non-conventional weapons, whether it be tactical nuclear or chemical weapons, to say, no, but we have to do it because now we're facing NATO and with the bulk of our ground forces bogged down in Ukraine, we can't defend ourselves without escalation. And B, it would give him an excuse to wriggle out of having brought Russia into a catastrophic and essentially unwinnable war at vast cost against his neighbor by saying, you see, it was what we'd been lying about for weeks. It was to preempt a NATO intervention in Ukraine. Mm. It was something we had to do. Oh, and by the way, the Russian army isn't losing catastrophically to mostly volunteers with light weapons. It's losing to a US-backed NATO coalition. And it would basically strengthen his regime and increase its ability to continue the war longer term.
Yeah, Vladimir Putin is the master of the self-fulfilling prophecy. Justin Bronk, thank you very much for your expertise. Really helpful and insightful. Thank you.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Take care. Thanks.
Before you go, Vitaly, we have this question from Alan, who is in Essex, which is a county in the southeast of England. How are Russia coping with their estimated 6,000 fatalities in terms of logistically repatriating bodies back into Russia and for their propaganda campaign in explaining that to the Russian people?
Well, they are not even talking about those fatalities. I'll give an example. A few days ago, there was a chat show on the Russian Defense Ministry's TV station called Zvezda, means star. And one of the panelists said, our lads are fighting in Ukraine for the just cause. Let's hold a minute of silence just to honour them.
And he was, I saw that footage.
And he was shouted down by the host. He said, no, you can't talk about that. They're doing the right thing. We don't talk about fatalities.
Really?
Because they realise that by bringing the subject up, they make things worse. They bring back memories of Afghanistan. Mm. But
does that mean no bodies of dead Russian soldiers are being taken back to Russia?
They've acknowledged fatalities. They've acknowledged, I think,
498.
Right.
About a week ago now. Since then, no updates. It's a taboo subject, precisely for the reason that this is one of those things that can completely undermine the Kremlin's strategy. Bodies are coming back, but we've also heard reports of them being abandoned as well. It's one of those developments which will be keenly watched by the West. What sort of impact, news of mounting casualties and fatalities in Ukraine, what sort of impact they have on the public opinion in Russia? Will it be the thing that will convince Russians that, well, actually, this price is too high to pay?
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, it's not just the Kremlin or Russians who don't want to talk about their own fatalities in war. I think any country at war does not like to go on about how many soldiers it's lost. It's bad for morale. But just looking at the numbers, you see all sorts of figures. The Kremlin, I think they have 498, as you said, Vitaly. The Ukrainians say they've killed upwards of 10,000, right? 12,000, yeah. And the US assessment is 5,000 to 6,000. Who knows where the truth really lies? Let's say the real figure is somewhere in between the Russian figure of 500 and the Ukrainian figure of 12,000. So let's say the American figure is vaguely accurate, 5,000 to 6,000. The number of Soviet soldiers who were killed in a decade of war in Afghanistan in a decade of war was 15,000.
Wow.
Now, if a third of that number have been killed in 2 weeks, that is massive.
Yeah. By the way, let me tell you about Putin, which is a new podcast from BBC Radio 4, which tries to make sense of the man that we are all talking about. To understand what Vladimir Putin might do in the future, you need to understand his past, where he's come from, what he's lived through, what he's done.
He was a slight boy, small hands, small firm hands. He studied boxing, but boxing didn't work out for him. So then he chose judo. And judo, he himself said many times over that it wasn't just a sport, it's a philosophy. And that's how he approached it. And we've seen again, time and again, how he uses sort of judo philosophy that you go for the weakness opening and weakness of the opponent to achieve his goals.
And you can find that on BBC Sounds or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's going to be fascinating.
Yeah. Thank you, Vitaly. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Vitaly.
Thank you.
Please do keep sending your questions. Gabriel, what is the WhatsApp number? If people want to send a voice note, which I love to hear people's
voices.
Yeah,
it's really good to hear your voices. It's +44 330 123 4220. So +44 330 123 4220.
Or you can email ukrainecast@bbc.co.uk or use the hashtag ukrainecast on Twitter or Instagram.
Keep the questions coming because it helps us to focus what we look at and try and pick apart.
Thank you very much for your company. And wherever you're listening in the world, take care.
Bye-bye.
Ukrainecast from BBC News.